All right, I don't hear any more car doors closing or any more footsteps, so a great good morning to you. This beautiful late spring morning, it's just absolutely gorgeous out there. Save a Saturday for this month was yesterday, and if you take a look around at the grounds and the buildings, you'll see that a great deal got done. Really, the place really looks nice, and so a heartfelt thank you, a deeply felt thank you to those devotees who came and served their center so very well. Thank you so much. Here's something new. Swami Sarvadevanandaji, who is our head minister, as you may know, I serve as resident minister. Swami Sarvadevananda has asked us to organize a Memorial Day retreat for Monday, May 27th. He's asked us to join in a tradition that started with Swami Swahananda in Hollywood of reading from Swami Vivekananda's complete works on Memorial Day. Reading material will be provided. We will start at 10:30 a.m. and sometime right around noon we should be finished. When we're finished reading, there'll be a short worship followed by a potluck lunch. So if you have no other plans for Memorial Day, that will be a nice way to spend. It creates quite an atmosphere. I participated many times in this in Hollywood before I moved out here. And so Swami Sarvadevananda is now moving this out to the other centers that he's responsible for. And so this will be our first year. It's on Memorial Day, Monday, May 27th, a little more than a week from today. And so if you can come starting at 10:30, and if you can't get here at 10:30, come at 11, there'll still be stuff to read. Also, please mark your calendar for a weekend retreat, and we now have the dates, the 20th and 21st of July, a weekend retreat with Swami Chandrasekharanandaji, who's head of the Portland, Oregon Vedanta Society. He'll visit us on that Saturday and Sunday and share his wisdom on karma yoga. Some of you have heard me talk about some little difficulties with the bookshop. Just a bookshop note, cash will no longer be accepted except on Sundays and on Tuesdays and Wednesdays evenings when we have class. Cash will be accepted on Sundays for bookshop purchases and on Tuesday and Wednesday evenings. Otherwise, please bring a check to buy books, or we're arranging for you to be able to use PayPal also. Younger people are quite adept at using PayPal on their phone. So we're arranging to make that available. Final announcement, please note that your center will be closed in August. No activities except arati, which will be done primarily by devotees. I'll be away some of that month. This will be our routine each summer. We'll be closed in August so that I'll be able to get a break. Are there any other announcements I should have made but didn't think to make? Okay. We'll start with our chant. This ancient chant translated by Swami Yogeshananda that reminds us of why we're here this morning and of our relationship with the divine being. Om Sahana Vavatu Sahano Bhunaktu Sahaviryam Karavavahai Tejasvinavaditamastu mavidvishavahai. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. May the Divine Being look over us lovingly as a mother and father. May the Divine Being support and nourish us as a mother and father. May we have the strength and skill to study together the art of spirituality. May no misunderstandings arise amongst us. Om, peace, peace, peace. Peace be unto us and to all beings everywhere. There are many songs about freedom. Here's one that some of you may be very familiar with. It's a heartfelt song. Somewhere over the rainbow, way up high, there's a land that I heard of once in a lullaby. Somewhere over the rainbow, skies are blue, and the dreams that you dare to dream really do come true. Someday I'll wish upon a star and wake up where the clouds are far behind me, where troubles melt like lemon drops away above the chimney tops. That's where you'll find me. Somewhere over the rainbow, skies are blue, and the dreams that you dare to dream really do come true. Somewhere over the rainbow, bluebirds fly. Birds fly over the rainbow. Why then, oh, why can't I? Somewhere over the rainbow, bluebirds fly. Birds fly over the rainbow. Why then, oh, why can't I? We all yearn for freedom. That song, as you may recall, was a song written for Judy Garland to sing in the film Wizard of Oz. And if you want to hear a proper rendition of it, you can find her rendition of it on YouTube. It's beautiful. She sang it so beautifully. What a voice. As most of you know who come regularly, this is a month for the study of Jnana Yoga, Advaita Vedanta. As a Jnana Yogi, you practice discrimination, reason, detachment, and satyagraha, insistence on truth. The goal is freedom from all limitation, mukti. Our teachers say that our miseries in life are caused by seeing inaccurately. An earnest and persistent jnani may break through this misapprehension called maya and see only the divine presence everywhere in everything and everyone. When we learn to see accurately, what will we see? Swami Vivekananda said, "Come up, O lions, and shake off the delusion that you are sheep. You are souls immortal, spirits free, blessed and eternal. Ye are not matter. Ye are not bodies. Matter is your servant, not you the servant of matter. Each of you is only a conduit for the infinite ocean of knowledge and power that lies behind mankind. You are a conduit for an infinite ocean of knowledge and power, and yet, though you may start each day with clear priorities and a plan of action, often, by the end of that day, you can hardly say where the time went. What happened? The short answer is you got distracted. In the moment, something else seemed more important than what you intended, or an incident occurred that left you feeling angry, dejected, worn out. Either way, the day is gone, and you're not much closer to what you planned than you were in the morning. Must this continue? Why are we so easily distracted? And why does that happen? And why does what happens frustrate, confuse, even anger us? Here's one explanation. It's from Swami Yogeshananda's article, A Closer Look Through the Looking Glass. In a lecture in which he clarifies the doctrine of Maya, Swami Vivekananda says, I may be dreaming all the time. I am dreaming that I am talking to you and that you are listening to me. No one can prove that it is not a dream. We are walking in the midst of a dream, half sleeping, half waking, passing all our lives in a haze. This is the fate of every one of us. When we dream, the things we see all seem to be connected. During the dream, we never think they are incongruous. It is only when we wake that we see the want of connection. When we wake from this dream of the world and compare it with the reality, it will be found all incongruous nonsense, a mass of incongruity passing before us. We do not know whence or whither, but we know it will end. And this is called Maya. In today's talk, we'll look further into Swami Vivekananda's definition of Maya and discuss Adi Shankaracharya's explanation of how we can wake from Maya's spell. Swami Vivekananda, as you know, those of you who've been studying here a while know that the book Jnana Yoga, there's some out on the little table under Mother's picture there. In the book Jnana Yoga, which is a collection of Swami Vivekananda's lectures, he defines Maya very, very carefully. So we'll hear a little bit of that, a little bit more of that. Swami Yogeshananda quoted him. There'll be another quote later. But in the meantime, we will look at what Adi Shankaracharya, the great exponent of Jnana, Advaita Vedanta, we'll look at his explanation of how we can wake from Maya's spell. Shankara says that with sustained attention, Viveka, discrimination between the real and the unreal, and Vairagya, release of worldly desires and attachments, will certainly lead an aspirant forward in spiritual life, and so at last to realization, and life as a Jivan Mukta, one who is liberated while still embodied. This is the desired goal, Jivan Mukti, to be still not waiting for death, not waiting for Shiva to whisper the mantra in your ear, but achieving your freedom while you're still embodied. So we'll further define and discuss these two components of a Jnana Yogi's sustained attention, these practices that are central to Shankara's teachings. First, viveka. It means discrimination between the relative reality and the highest truth, the absolute. The absolute is infinite, unchanging, undivided, called Satchidananda, existence, knowledge, bliss, or love, absolute. The issue for us is that the absolute is unknowable by the impure mind. So how can we discriminate? The best we can do is say, that's not it. That's not it. Neti neti, the negative way, via negativa, as it's called by the Catholics. But when we say, that's not it, what is it we mean when we say, not it? All that is relative. Within the relative are time, space, and causation. This is the definition, an English definition. It's not comprehensive, but it's close. For Maya, time, space, and causation, finite, not infinite, finite, constantly changing, not unchanging, it's constantly changing. And soham, identified as a separate I, instead of undivided, it seems to be a separate I, in which, from which arises I, me, mine. Also, and this is sometimes not taken into account by those who are looking at the Jnana path, that within time, space, and causation, within Maya, are Ishvara and Ishwari. They are the rulers of Maya, no doubt, as Krishna says very explicitly in the Gita. And from time to time, they take human form as divine incarnations. And yet the jnani, the fierce jnani, though acknowledging that they exist within time, space, and causation, say also, not that, not that. So it's an austere path. And the austerity has to do with this word vairagya. Release of worldly desires and attachments, even attachments to the divine presence within time, space, and causation, Ishvara, Ishwari. Release of worldly desires and attachments, detachment from the rajasic and tamasic activities of the mind, and yea, even finally, from the sattvic activities of the mind, even sattva is not the reality. With this release comes self-control, or self-control and this release go together. Self-control with your senses under restraint yields serenity of mind. You attain clarity of vision. Clarity of vision. A calm mind produces clearer vision. You attain clarity of vision and peace of mind when you have learned to control your attention. For the purposes of the rest of this talk, this assertion is made. You are your attention. And until you achieve final realization of the truth of your being, in other words, Jivan Mukta, until that final realization of the truth, your attention is the only thing you can truly control. So I'll repeat that because it's basic now to what the rest of the talk is going to say. For the purposes of the rest of this talk, this assertion is made. You are your attention. And until you achieve final realization of the truth of your being, that attention is the only thing you can truly control. Behind Maya, which is a projection of the impure mind and is your apparent reality, is the Atman, also called pure consciousness, the unchanging witness of change. So Atman, pure consciousness, the unchanging witness of change, Brahman, this consciousness, awareness, witness, Brahman, are all the same. So behind your waking awareness, behind your dream-sleep awareness, behind even your unconsciousness in deep sleep, there abides this pure consciousness, the witness. We experience that witness. We experience it. I'm going to call it by that name. We experience it from moment to moment, as attention. though we don't usually have much control of our attention, it just wanders here and there, that is the witness. So we experience it, the witness, from moment to moment as attention, which we can deliberately focus here or there, or allow to be distracted by desire, attachment, and aversion. So the question we want to answer to make progress, the question we want to answer is, what deserves your attention? Each of the yogas, as a spiritual practice for gaining control of your attention, has a different answer. Jnana, the path of knowledge, says, only the highest truth deserves my attention. Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman, Tattvamasi, thou art that. All else is misapprehension and a superimposition on the reality. The common way of thinking about this is we come across a rope coiled up in the dark, we think it's a snake and react as if it's a snake. That's a common example of superimposition of the mind, mistaking one thing for another. Neti Neti says to the, it says, not this, not that, to both the snake and the rope. They're both a perception within Maya. They're both within Maya. Anything that you can perceive or think about is, by definition, within Maya. This is what I mean by the austerity of the jnana path. You reject even the knowledge, lower knowledge, of the reality that is the rope that you misperceived as a snake. You reject even that. You discriminate against even that. So let me just repeat that. Jnana, the path of knowledge, says, only the highest truth, I am Brahman, deserves my attention. All else is a misapprehension and a superimposition on the reality. And so the jnani says, neti neti, even to the snake and the rope, both are within Maya. Anything that you can perceive or think about is by definition within Maya. Bhakti, on the other hand, the path of devotion, says, Ishvara or Ishwari, the Lord alone within time, space, and causation, is worthy of my attention. That's all I wish to see. Ultimately, through my relationship with Ishwari and Ishvara or Ishwari, which becomes a servant relationship or a child relationship, in other words, a relationship of self-surrender, ultimately, through that self-surrender, I will realize my oneness with that living divine presence and be free. So I'll repeat the bhakti, the path of definition, says, the Lord alone is worthy of my attention. That is all I wish to see. Ultimately, through self-surrender, I will realize my oneness with that living divine presence and be free. Raja, the path of meditation or psychic control, the Raja Yogi says, I practice disciplines which disallow the ability of the world to capture and hold my attention. I turn my attention only to the Atman within. And if you look at the steps of Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, you see this methodic practice, these disciplines, which disallow the ability of the world to capture and hold the Raja Yogi's attention. The Raja Yoga says, I turn my attention to the Atman within and the Atman alone. Karma, the path of action, says, I pay attention only to the action itself, with no attachment to the action or the results of that action. As Krishna says in the Gita, this yields peace of mind, And finally, full control of your attention. You become like an expert dancer. You cannot put a foot wrong. Why? Because there's absolutely nothing between you and the motivation, nothing between the dancer and the music. There's no selfishness. One of the characteristics of the karma yogi's path is an abandonment of selfishness. So karma, the path of action, I pay attention only to the action itself, with no attachment to the action or the results of that action. This yields peace of mind and finally full control of my attention. I become like an expert dancer. I cannot put a foot wrong. Bhagavad Gita contains instruction in all these four yogas. It is Sri Krishna's blessed instruction manual for playing the game of human life. And that's what he tells Arjuna in the beginning. I'm going to tell you how to play this game that you've decided you're not going to play because you've gotten sentimental about what will happen if you destroy your enemies. So any of you who wish to take up Bhagavad Gita, let me know, and we'll organize a class on that. Right now, our classes on Tuesday and Wednesday evenings are on the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna on Tuesday evening and Swami Vivekananda's Jnana Yoga on Wednesday evening. We're nearing the end of the Gospel. We could replace that Tuesday evening with the Bhagavad Gita class. I have another thought, but if there are enough of you who want to study the Bhagavad Gita, we can do it on Tuesday evenings at 8 o'clock. All right. Bhagavad Gita contains instruction in all these four yogas. Very profound instruction. It is Sri Krishna's instruction manual for playing the game of human life and winning. Now, what does winning mean? Winning means becoming Jivan Mukta, becoming free while embodied. Through spiritual practice, as taught by Adi Shankaracharya, Sri Krishna, Sri Ramakrishna, and others, you can learn to control your attention and thereby your senses and your mind. All you have to do is look at these great and glorious swamis that come and visit us. You will have an opportunity with Chandrasekharananda to take a close look at a swami for a couple of days. Swami Yogatmananda is coming in November and December. Swami Chidbrahmananda is coming. We don't know just when yet. He's posted in Washington. So you'll have a chance to take a look at these men, and we'll have some Pravrajikas coming, probably not this year, but next. They're under tremendous pressure, the Pravrajikas. There's so few of them, so I hesitate to ask them to come. In any event, through spiritual practice, as taught by Adi Shankaracharya, Sri Krishna, Sri Ramakrishna, and others, you can learn to control your attention. That witness aspect of yourself that is peering out into universe. You can control that like a searchlight. You can learn to control it like a searchlight. You make a very deliberate and steady transition from living even an extraordinary worldly existence to abiding in an ever higher truth, knowledge of the self, the Atman. In the three steps described in the talk, self-discovery, self-actualization, self-realization, this self-actualization phase, it's a long spectrum. Once you have discovered the self within, once you feel that living presence, as Swami Prabhupada said, then it begins this process. Just exactly like the dancer that becomes the expert dancer, you learn and learn and learn about controlling your attention, and thereby controlling your mind, controlling your senses. All of these disciplines, it's usually a blend of the four yogas that you're practicing. And so you move very deliberately and steadily from living even an extraordinary worldly existence to abiding in an ever higher truth, knowledge and actualization of the self, the Atman. That means the attributes of Saguna Brahman become the attributes of your life. We'll leave the last word, as often we do, to Swami Vivekananda. As I said, we'd quote again from Swamiji about Maya. Here he defines the limitations that we become free of when we achieve life's only purpose, that is, the knowledge of the truth, of the reality, of the absolute, the realization. So this begins the quote from Swamiji. This eternal play of light and darkness, indiscriminate, indistinguishable, inseparable, is always there. A fact, yet at the same time not a fact. Awake and at the same time asleep. This is a statement of facts, and this is what we call Maya. We are born in this Maya, we live in it, we think in it, we dream in it, we are philosophers in it, we are spiritual people in it. Nay, we are devils in this Maya, and we are also gods in this Maya. Stretch your ideas as far as you can, make them higher and higher, call them infinite or by any other name you please, even these ideas are within this Maya. It cannot be otherwise. And the whole of human knowledge is a generalization of this Maya, trying to know it as it appears to be. This is the work of Nama Rupa, name and form. Everything that has form, everything that calls up an idea in your mind, is within Maya. Everything that has form, everything that calls up an idea in your mind, is within Maya. For everything that is bound by the laws of time, space, and causation is within Maya. I'm going to read that paragraph again, see if I can't read it clearly. This is the work of Nama Rupa, name and form. Everything that has form, everything that calls up an idea in your mind, is within Maya. For everything that is bound by the laws of time, space, and causation is within Maya. This is why there are those other paths, which are elaborated on very sweetly and nicely in the Gita. The bhakti path, the raja path, the karma path. It is so hard to truly reject, that is, discriminate against everything that is within Maya. It is so hard to do that. Very few minds can achieve it. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't make the attempt. Blessings on you if you make the attempt. But as we gestured to in the introduction, an earnest and persistent jnani may break through this misapprehension, this Maya, and not only realize but become Brahman, the divine presence, the absolute, everywhere, in everything, and in everyone. That's the goal of the jnani. This is what happens when the jnani attains sufficient control of her or his attention. Now it's your turn. Please make a comment, ask a question. Let's be present to one another here now as a congregation, raising one another up by our wisdom, by our intuition, by our insight. Share with us what all this has given rise to in you. Yes?
I had a realization. Was speaking about not it.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a realization that not it is very important.
Yes.
Because it leads you, once you understand it and then start to practice it, it leads you to the next not it. Which leads you to the next not it.
Yes.
And so on.
Very well said, Robert.
If one piece of the puzzle makes no sense, but if you continue with it and assemble the complete puzzle, then you have a picture. And then with that picture, if you understand it and practice it, then it takes you to another dimension of not it.
Yes, exactly. The subtle dimension of not it.
And if I suspect you could never get to it, because if you did, the game would be over.
Well, what happens according to Patanjali is, as you make the effort, something happens to you. It's like being at the top of the water slide. You've made all the effort to climb all the way to the top of the water slide. Now you're there. What happens? You let go, and something happens to you. This is according to him. This is samadhi, the highest samadhi, and liberation are not something that you do.
And it seems to me that it's connected with death, because at a point, that's it.
Yes. This is why the Swamis of our order wear those orange robes. They are a metaphor for having committed a kind of psychic suicide, death, in the fire of Brahman. And so now they're wearing that fire to remind them and everyone else of their status. Yes, you're absolutely right. It is a death. It is a death of misapprehension.
I see it as a death of the physical, but not the death of the spiritual. It just takes you to another level.
Yes. But you can remain in the human form. Those who do, generally speaking, do it, as Sri Ramakrishna said, out of either love or wisdom, to remain as teachers. The compassion of love or the compassion of wisdom, to remain as teachers. Otherwise, why stay? It's a beautiful thought. And so you can, when we look at these teachers, these great teachers, we see.
And once it goes to that next level, our physical methods and procedures of understanding does not apply. Mm-hmm. And that's why we can never get to it.
Mm-hmm.
While we're in this physical level of existence.
Yes. We can get close, but no cigar.
Very close. And each one of these not it's so closer, a little closer to it.
Yeah. That's the self-actualization.
Yeah.
But, you know, that long spectrum of self-actualization. It becomes more and more what you are as a being. This is how saints are produced. Saints are self-actualized, perhaps even self-realized. But at least they're highly self-actualized. They are manifesting the attributes of the self. But as you said, it's still not it. Because it simply cannot be thought of. We can't think of it. We can't speak of it. It's what Jesus was speaking of when he said, "The peace that passeth all understanding." The peace that passeth all understanding. No way to understand it, speak of it, think of it. And yet, there it is. It is there. The reality is just behind the appearance. Thank you, Robert. Anybody else? Yes, dear.
I think conceptually, the neti-neti, maybe I get it. But how do I do it practically? I mean, at a very gross level, for example, I know that the shawl is, it's not, you know, it's a, the neti part, it's not real. Then what do I do with it?
All right. It just depends on what your priorities are, dear. Sri Ramakrishna, one time, took a notion. He would like to have a fine, fine shawl. And so he asked Mathur Babu for this fine shawl. And of course, Mathur Babu was most happy to provide him with one. And he took it and he put it on and he wore it for a while. And then he took it off and threw it on the ground, spit on it, and stomped on it, saying, by his actions, neti neti. He did the same thing with a rupee, which at that time was a gold coin and quite valuable. He took some clay, because it says in the scriptures, clay and gold are the same. He took both and threw them in the Ganga, threw them in the Ganges. And then, being the bhakta that he was, he thought, oh, perhaps I have offended Lakshmi by throwing away her money. So, it's our priorities. You know, what are our priorities? They're what allow us to... There's no reason not to have a shawl. No reason not to have a shawl. But what importance do you put on the shawl? If the shawl were stolen from you today, again, an example. Swami Brahmananda was up in the foothills of the Himalayas, I think Rishikesh. He was meditating in one of those huts that they have for the sadhus there. And it was cold. Cold at night, quite cold. At some point, someone came along and put a very nice, warm, woolen blanket, apparently a new one, at the threshold of the hut, and left it there. Because Brahmananda was in an ecstatic state, perhaps not samadhi, we don't know, but he was at least in an ecstatic state. He didn't break that and pick up the blanket. At some point later, someone came along and took the blanket. Did he mourn? Did he concern himself? No, it was just more of the play of the divine presence, of the play of Maya for him. Can we expect that level of detachment from ourselves? If we can't do it, we mustn't beat ourselves up about it. We can just say, I'm not there yet. But we can never compromise the ideal. The ideal is detachment. So we just do the best we can. We just do the best we can. Like I say, once we have this sense, this self-awareness, self-discovery, we know there's something there. We know that that's where we belong, where our attention belongs, where that's our true original nature. Behind that feeling, but the feeling is still within Maya. But nevertheless, we have that feeling. That's when self-actualization begins. But it's a long process. It can be accelerated through spiritual practice. That's why the spiritual practices, the workbook of the Gita, the workbook of Patanjali, the workbook of Narada's Bhakti Sutras, Adi Shankaracharya's Viveka Chudamani for Jnana, these workbooks are there. That's what they're for. So we take up these workbooks and we make the teachings, we assimilate the teachings as best we can. What does assimilate mean? Digest, make part of us, like food is digested and made part of us. If we just read something and it remains in our mind as an intellectual idea, fie. It means nothing. It literally means nothing. We may take great pride in the breadth and depth of our knowledge, but unless it affects us, unless we assimilate it, it's nothing. It's straw. So all of these workbooks are there. All of these paths are there. Ultimately, it's one path, but various ways to walk it, various ways to be on the path. So very good question. What about your shawl? Anyway, yes?
Thank you, Shankaraji. You brought all the four yogas into, one thing and for us to assimilate it. And thank you very much for that.
Mm.
But the thing that I, see, even this, taking the puzzle, we can never reach it. Maybe it takes time. But even during this time of keep on taking those puzzles, there will be a transformation.
Oh, yes.
And that transformation is what all we need in the beginning until we establish more and more into it. And that transformation is the Jivan Mukta.
Thank you. Not according to what Adi Shankaracharya says, not according to what Krishna says. The Jivan Mukta is there but doesn't know it. The Jivan Mukta, this is the process of self-actualization. The transformation you're talking about is the same thing that is being spoken of as self-actualization. And it is a process, and it can go quickly or it can go slowly, depending on the intensity of your effort. As the great Jnani Nisargadatta Maharaj said, everything yields to earnestness. So whatever the path you're treading, whatever the combination of the four yogas or the one yoga, if you've said, I'm just going to stick to one, the earnestness of your attempt will govern the speed of your transformation. But you're absolutely right. The transformation is the thing. And it can be really successfully argued that the journey is the goal.
Yes.
And I think that's what you were saying. The journey is the goal. Because we don't know anything beyond where we are in the journey. That's all we know. So it isn't like climbing a mountain. It's really not. It's more like just following the path through the forest, through the forest, through the forest. That's why that wonderful story, The Wizard of Oz, is told the way it is. Follow the yellow brick road. Thank you. Yes, Paul.
Thank you for the talk. I also really enjoyed it and appreciated the snake in the rope and all this. I remember the last time when I asked you about that, you told me about a cartoon that shows the student going to the guru with an actual snake attached, biting him in the fanny, and he's complaining. You told me it was just a rope.
Yeah.
I like that. Gave me a little bit of a lighthearted view on it. But there's something about this. I find part of myself resisting your message.
Ah.
You know that.
I'm not surprised.
It's like, well, really, do I really want to die completely? I mean, don't I enjoy the smell of flowers? Don't I enjoy my wife? Don't I enjoy my boat?
Of course. So be a bhakta. Take the bhakta path to yourself. Be a bhakta and a karmi, and go forward. There's no imperative to be a jnani. By all means, enjoy the flowers, love your wife. This is the bhakta's path. And by far and away, the majority of human beings, this is what Sri Ramakrishna recommended for now, particularly this time in this world, the path of the bhakta and the karmi. And it was even light on the karma. It was heavy on the devotion, light on the karma. Because the karma yogi's path is also a very demanding path. It means the release of attachment to all action. Just action is something happening in your presence and you have no involvement other than just your participation, and the results are, whatever they are, demanding. So you're right. You do not have to be a jnani.
Well, there seems to be something in the nama rupa, you know, that it somehow seems is being minimized, or that it's too, that message of the jnani is a little too all or nothing. That is really dismissing what appears to us as the physical, the world of time and space and physical objects. And I think you said something about the goal, or the destination is the journey, or the goal is, mm-hmm. is the journey.
The journey is the goal, yes.
You know, that somehow that seems to me, that seems to be devaluing the process of living and the process of birth and death and attachments and struggling and history, and it seems like there's something of value in that physical, that odyssey or journey of the human race, that has some intrinsic purpose and value that gets lost if I just go directly to the absolute.
You've just spoken very eloquently as a bhakta. This is the argument of the bhakta. This is the argument of the devotee who says, I do not want to shun all of this. And Sri Ramakrishna made a very strong argument based on what he called vijnana, special knowledge, that the absolute and the relative are exactly the same, exactly equivalent. Water still, water in waves, vibration. This is vibration. These are vibration translation machines. We translate what is vibration into the reality we experience. He said, water still, water in waves, same water. Snake still, coiled up. Snake wriggling, notice the wave form again. Snake wriggling, same snake. So this is a powerful argument, but it requires for it to be fully understood and fully lived as you intend to live it as a spiritual being. It requires that you attain knowledge of God, that these not be just ideas, that they are a reality for you. That water still and water in waves, same water. So a spiritual path or some combination of the yogas must be pursued until there is at least Savikalpa Samadhi. This is what Swami Prabhupada would say, who people who wanted to talk to him about the highest, the absolute, and all this. He would say, this Nirvikalpa Samadhi, very well. He said, first achieve Savikalpa Samadhi. The Samadhi that Jesus was speaking of when he said, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God or know God, depending on how you translate the Aramaic. This is still within the realm of time, space, and causation. It is an experience. It is a perception. But it is a perception that drives all other perceptions to the periphery. You are overwhelmed by the knowledge of God. So first achieve this, is what is being said. Then the discussion can begin about what the value is. Sri Ramakrishna said, if you're weighing a bell fruit is a valuable food commodity. If you're going to weigh the bell fruit, you cannot just cut out the flesh and weigh only the flesh. You must also weigh the seeds and the skin, the husk. You have to take it all into account. So all of this is pointing to just exactly what you were saying. We have manifested this. If we buy the premise that there is the divine being in this room having human experiences, these 20-odd people here, one divine being, Brahman, having human experiences, this didn't happen by accident. We're doing this. We, as that divine being, are doing this. As Sri Krishna says in the Gita, the Atman created you for its own purposes. And the sooner you discern those purposes, which is one of the purposes of meditation, then the more successful you can be at manifesting those purposes, which is self-actualization.
Thank you. That answers my concern.
Good.
Seems like to me, Zabramau, too, also, as long as we're in a physical existence, dealing with physical stuff, we want things to happen now.
Oh, yes.
We don't have the patience to wait, but I think what we have to do is learn, and how you do that is I think the reason we're here.
Well,
to recognize that time does not exist.
Yes.
You know, whatever it is that we want to accomplish can happen, but it has to happen in its own time. It can't happen in our time.
Well, Robert, you have sat at this piano and played beautifully. You did not do that overnight. It took you years and years to manifest that, as Swami Vivekananda says, education is nothing more than the manifestation of the perfection already within the human being. So that you have come a long way toward manifesting that perfection in your art and craft of piano playing. And this is self-actualization. And you're right, we are impatient. It's one of the ways that we indulge in disturbing our minds, keeping our minds unpeaceful by being impatient.
But the whole universe is physically set up to encourage us to be impatient. There's nothing in this physical world that leads us toward being patient. So we have to kind of go against the grain.
Yes. Oh, that's exactly right. As John Dobson said,
how few people are in this room, and how many people live in this community?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Well, as the great cosmologist and Vedantic philosopher John Dobson said, we have to learn to counter-cheat our genes. Our genes are cheating us. They're making us impatient. I want it now. I want to eat. I want to procreate now. That's what our genes are basically,
yeah,
you know, thrusting us toward. So we have to learn to counter-cheat, he said, our genes. And counter-cheating our genes is hard work. But it is the work that we are in this room to do, yes? Beautiful, wonderful. And I suggest that, by and large, we're all doing a pretty good job of it. You know, each day may not be our best day. Certainly, I can say that of some of my own. But it is a yes, dear.
I have a thought. Not only the genes, I think our environment also disturbed us while we were growing up.
Oh yes.
You know, our surroundings, caretakings, and all these things influenced us the way we are. Now we are searching for the real authenticity of ourselves and trying to really find the truth and divinity within ourselves.
Yes.
And to answer your question, I was just thinking, a lot of times we want everything in our own terms. We want life to be in our terms.
Mm-hmm.
And life doesn't go that way. So we have to tune our minds. Hey, it is what it is. We have to go on life's terms. Mm-hmm. Then slowly the detachment process works. I'm just thinking.
This is why Patanjali preaches Santosha to us.
Yes.
Be content with the circumstances
exactly.
of your life.
Contentment.
Contentment.
Uh-huh.
But it is not easy because our genes are not content.
It's a journey. That's what you said.
Yeah.
Journey.
It is. And the more we celebrate it,
yes.
And you're absolutely right that environment helps disturb our minds. As you practice concentration and meditation.
Yes.
What you find is a lot of this self-talk going on inside that as you listen to it, you say, oh, I recognize who's doing that talking.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's somebody in our past. They've left these strong mental impressions on us, usually of inadequacy, of somehow you're falling short. And so we continue to accuse ourselves that way instead of being our own best friend and saying, no, you're doing fine. You're doing fine.
We have to actually alter our brains a little bit.
Yes, and they are plastic. This is one of the glories.
Yes.
You know, there's plenty of real scientific evidence of the plasticity
Definitely.
Of the brain.
Neuroscience is proving that it can be altered.
Yes.
And which is very possible. That's what we're
doing. This is why the Buddhist monks, you know, they're out there Emory University, and they're being studied. And one of the things... one of the studies that was done, they were putting these electrodes all over their heads. And so some of the other Buddhist monks just began to laugh. And the researchers were, what are you laughing about? Well, you're putting them on the wrong place. If you really want to learn something, put them around here. You know, this is just a machine for, you know, if you want to learn something about what's really going on, put them here. No. We want to find out about the brainwaves. Okay, so we found out about the brainwaves. Yes, Dr. Munch.
You know, that example has been many times brought up. But I would say Buddhists are wrong too. What does it tell you that the heart and everything is up here? Now we say the intestine with the bacteria, that is our second brain. And that is true also. It does,
yes.
It does dominate the process of thinking, those bacteria. So this is flying away from the truth. That in my opinion, we don't have a lack of perception. We have a lack of practice. So that we keep on cheating ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And we blame the genes.
Mm-hmm.
What could I do? These are my genes.
Mm-hmm.
But gene also is a genie which you can bottle if you want to.
Uh-huh.
Bottle means you know. And one way I think, and this was the eternal problem, from eternity. Duryodhana says that jānāmi dharmam nacame nivṛtte, jānāmi dharmam nacame pravṛtte. I know what is right, but I cannot practice it.
Mm-hmm.
I know what is wrong, but I cannot help stopping it. And that's what a Latin poet has the same thing. I know what is right, and what is wrong, but it always goes the wrong path. Mm-hmm. So what is that? That is the Maya which you are talking about.
Oh, yes.
It shoots a veil before you.
Yes.
And in my simple experience, what I think, because we are talking about death, but personally we all feel we are not going to die. Mm-hmm. And that is the biggest deception, not the snake and the rope. The biggest deception of my eyes, that you know you are going to die, but you will not admit it. Mm-hmm. And once you see from that standpoint, then death and disease are the two fundamental instruments God has given us in our hands to learn the futility of the life that we are living and how to make it more meaningful. But we don't learn it. Right now, if I stand here before this crowd and say, we are all going to die. Yes, brother, we are going to die. He said, you are going to die and are you going to live forever? See, huh? That is the bite back of the ego, mm-hmm. and the false notion that we are going to die. But in many ways, I think now that death is a tremendous teacher.
Oh, yes.
And impending death keeps on teaching us and we keep on paying no attention to it.
Yes.
Simple thing. Right now, you might be thinking about what I will do for supper.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Okay? But if this is my last moment, why do I have to worry about the supper?
Oh, yes. Exactly. We're oftentimes living right outside the moment.
So that transitional state in which you are passing through, to accept it from the heart,
yes,
or brain, or the guts, whatever you want to call it, that to me is the way to Vedanta. Hmm. But that's okay. If I'm living, I'll worry about that one.
Yes.
But if I don't, why worry about it?
Well, this is why we learn to observe our attention. Where is my attention gone? Has my attention gone to what I'm going to have for dinner? Is that where I want to have my attention? So what deserves my attention? Well, I bring it right back to this moment. Yeah, what's wrong with this moment?
Retirement. Yes. Retirement was a good experience. It's a professional death.
Yes.
It is a professional death. That's after retirement. Now what happens to Grady, where I was working for 50 years, does not matter to me.
Yes.
But 3 years back, it says, there's a fire in Grady. Oh my gosh, my department.
Yes. Right. Exactly.
So detachment is not as difficult as we think. If we put it in the perceptive.
Yes.
The perspective has to develop first. Yes. That's our point.
Uma.
If I may slightly bring down the discussion to day-to-day actual practical problems.
Yes.
Of computer. I am having 2 to 3 days of struggle. Fixed gate is giving me all kinds of problems. Now I am trying to apply. Where is my attention? My attention, most of the time, is whatever I can do, understand, through logic, through knowledge, through bhakti.
Mm-hmm.
And this is material thing, this mundane problem. Is not going to stay forever. But for now, how do I tackle that problem with Vedanta knowledge? And I'm thinking, how lucky was Ramakrishna and Vivekananda in those times? They did not have to deal with all these computers.
They had their own issues.
So such a simple world, yes, with simple problems. And now, because she said, just like I said, it's so complicated.
Exactly.
That even if you want to stay above all these things, these little frustrations of life, call it computer, call it interpersonal relationships, many, many kinds of. So if we accept that this is the world of Maya, and something or other is always going to show up to disturb our equilibrium.
Oh, yes.
But what I found that helps me is again and again to remind that, okay, because you are in this world, these are going to happen. It may have different names, form, but how do I deal with it is through every day giving a prep talk to my own mind through bhakti, through meditation, that, okay, this also will pass.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there will be peace and normality and all that.
Yes, so it's very hard not to get...
It's a practical approach.
It's very hard not to get frustrated and angry with the things of the world. Yes, at first...
That's
Swayam. Swayam, and then Robert, yes.
Without meaning to sound, you know, argumentative, Sri Ramakrishna sure didn't have to deal with computer, but on the other hand, he didn't have electricity or the swarupin kapara idea to meditate, you know. He could just click on the thing and get a light, so they have different set of challenges.
Yeah, sure. But it's getting more complicated.
Robert?
Like you said a few minutes ago that the Buddha said they're putting electrodes in the wrong place and you put them here. I think, well, my past started with the realization that I was not my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Because as long as you think that you are your mind, every thought that comes here is very important and significant to you.
Yes.
Once you recognize that you are not your mind, the mind is just another one of your tools that you have at your access, and you don't have to follow what your mind is saying because it has continuous dialogue going on 24/7.
Yes.
It does not stop.
Yeah, and there's a very, very good explanation for that, which will be given in another talk about what it is that actually produces your thoughts.
And once you recognize that, I don't have to follow these thoughts.
Mm-mm.
I don't have to follow this mind. I can select the path.
Oh, you can turn the searchlight elsewhere.
Once I select this path, if I can maintain it, then... I have mastered the mind. So it's either the mind going to master you or you mastering it.
Well, then,
it's a challenge.
Precisely.
It's an ongoing challenge. It's a struggle.
Well, it's a struggle in the beginning, but if you persist and consistent with it, you can bring the mind right under control, just like your children.
That's what Sri Krishna says to Arjuna. Yes, Arjuna says, "Oh, the wind is not more wild than the mind." And Sri Krishna says, "Yes, yes, but you can bring it under control."
Surviving as a spiritual being and evolving to where you intended to go, as long as the mind is mastering you.
Yeah.
Because the minute you sit down and meditate, it's going to tell you all the things that you can do. Why are you wasting your time sitting here meditating?
Mm-hmm.
You can be doing so-and-so.
Oh, yeah.
You have to have the strength to say, shut up.
Well, that's probably better not to say shut up.
And do what it is you intend to do.
Probably better to deal with it. Probably, Robert, better to deal with it more lovingly than shut up. You know how children react when you say shut up. They may do it, but they'll resent it.
So there's different shut ups. And then there's shut up.
Well, but you're right. What the real secret is, as you said, it's going on 24/7, 365.
Yep.
If you practice concentration and meditation, what happens is you sink below the thoughts. They're going on. But it's like the water, the surface of a lake being ruffled by the water, by the wind. The surface of the lake being ruffled by the wind. It's of no consequence to you. You're well toward the bottom, and you're in a realm of calm. So this is what's called sinking into silence. Ultimately, we reach silence. Silence is what? No vibration. And when there's no vibration, then there's none of this apparent reality. So this is very beautifully described by Swami Vivekananda in his introduction to Raja Yoga. So the thoughts, as you said, the thoughts are something that is going on, and once we learn to focus our attention and control the process of generating the products of controlled attention, focus, concentration, then we begin to produce something really meaningful. I use the example of you playing the piano. When you're playing the piano most successfully, you're not thinking about it at all. The thoughts are going on, but the music is flowing through you and playing itself. This is this metaphor that Sri Ramakrishna used of the dancer who cannot put a foot wrong. They're not thinking about the music. If they think about it for a moment, they'll put a foot wrong. No, the music is moving the dancer, because they've learned to get everything else out of the way, and they've trained themselves to that level of perfection.
And that is true in the art.
Precisely. Sri Ramakrishna used music and dance very much because he loved them so. Yes?
You raised the question, what deserves attention?
Yes.
And, Ramakrishna and Swami Vivekananda, taught in before the era of developmental psychology and the psychology of the unconscious was known. And, it used to be said that, like from Descartes, that I think, therefore I am. But out of developmental psychology, the new paradigm is really more, my mother thinks, therefore I am. Or my culture thinks, therefore I am. That I'm not, that any, developmental trauma or, for whatever cause, or adult trauma, that this is all going to shape my psyche in a way that what catches my attention and what I choose to focus on is going to be a function of my unconscious patterns that were put in place by my by whatever my mother imprinted on me, or my dad imprinted, or my culture. They all left these residual, mostly unconscious imprints. And I guess, to discern, the light of truth, when my attention has already been hijacked and my attention has already been, corrupted, how do I get through that?
Well, you spoke about the unconscious and the thoughts and all of this, where they root from. Patanjali addresses this very directly. He was very aware of the unconscious and its contents, so to speak. The term that I prefer for that is the latent subconscious. The unconscious is something that we can never be aware of, but we can be aware of all of the contents of our mind through meditation, everything that we need to know. But basically, we have the power to redirect our attention away from all of that and not be at all mastered by our nurture, which is what you were pointing to. There's nature, the genealogy, and the bacteria of the guts, as Dr. Mudge was saying. All of this rested beyond just the genome, but as an expression of this. So there's nature and nurture. Both of these are not it. it, the Atman, the witness, is, Swami Vivekananda said, an infinite ocean of power and knowledge behind. Never, from this perspective, never compromise the ideal based on the findings of modern science. The findings of modern science are true in their context, but the ocean of consciousness, you know, Descartes had it asked backwards. It's not, I think, therefore I am. It's, I am, therefore I think.
That's what we think.
This is the Vedantic position. Consciousness is primary and not plural. There's one divine being expressing itself as everything that we can perceive in any sense of the word perception. Think about, see, hear, everything. Consciousness is primary and not plural. Advaita, not two. So all of this that you're saying is true for the mass of people. They are controlled by the contents of their nature and nurture. And so, as Thoreau pointed out, they lead lives of quiet desperation.
Mm-hmm. But that seems to me, you know, if my mother was an alcoholic, or my mother was a heroin addict, or whatever, and I'm born with fetal alcohol syndrome, or I'm born with alcohol syndrome that has such a profound effect on my consciousness that I'm not sure if I can assert the absoluteness of
the absolute is not concerned about whether it's asserted or not. In any given lifetime, it may not be possible for a human being, due to their karma, to pursue a spiritual path. We can look around us, and there are millions of people, many of whom are in some kind of church in this morning, but many of whom are not. And so they're going to spend a lifetime heavily afflicted by fetal alcohol syndrome or drug business or what have you, what happens to a fetus because of the mother's drug use. Or, for that matter, I don't think enough is known about what happens to the sperm when the father is indulging in these things, and what is carried forward through the father's line in these things. You know, it's so easy to point at the mother. But the fact is that at some small portion, Krishna points it out, of 1,000, he says, one will seek me. So the spiritual path in any given lifetime may not be for everyone. Swami Brahmananda was walking in the streets of Calcutta one afternoon, and a disciple was with him, and they saw someone literally drunk in the gutter, just completely blitzo in the gutter. This fellow had been a disciple, and was still, for that matter, a disciple of Swami Brahmananda. And the disciple who was walking with him pointed to this fellow and said, "Oh, how sad it is what he has become." Brahmananda did not turn a hair. He said, "Oh," he just walked on and said, "Oh, he's just backsliding a little." Just backsliding a little. Our adventure of being human, this being human, which is a verb, not a noun, this adventure that we're living is full of misadventures. And so, if as you pursue meditation, concentration and meditation, you find the evidence of a lot of these misadventures in your waking awareness, in your active subconscious, and in your latent subconscious. You find the evidence of them there. And you find their relative importance. You are able to put them in context to the point where, as Jesus said, I have overcome the world. All of that, the waking awareness, the active subconscious, the latent subconscious, all of it, I have overcome it all. Sri Ramakrishna did the same thing. He studied the 64 disciplines of the Tantra. He mastered them all within a 5-year period. The disciplines of the Tantra are to allow someone who succeeds to master all of their waking awareness, all of their active subconscious, and all of their latent subconscious. There is nothing that can overpower them. Now, are each of us going to do the 64 disciplines of the Tantra? We don't need to. These other paths have been created for us. Only one who wants to create a spiritual treasure box that he can dip into and give to each one who comes. Sri Ramakrishna said to these gentlemen who came to him, these gentlemen of Calcutta who came to him and challenged him, saying, tell us, why should we not enjoy the world? And Sri Ramakrishna said, go enjoy the world. I have no objection. But when you are sick of it, return to me. I have the cure. And he meant it. And he did. This is our belief. So, the cure is one of these paths that we're talking about in various forms. It's just take four exponentialize it. You see how many potentials there are. So we cannot look at the challenge of the world and say, I'm going to accept that as undefeatable. This is Arjuna's position. It's not worth it. I can't kill all of those things that I can't kill my mother's influence on me. Sri Krishna says, yes, you can. So, chapter 1 and chapter 2 of the Gita are two of the most important things that any human being can read and from sitting right here. Arjuna's reasons for not fighting and Krishna's reasons to get up, pick up your weapons.
Second chapter.
Yes. Sri Krishna's response. And then the third chapter, Sri Krishna says, even a little practice of this yoga will save you from the terrible wheel of rebirth and death. So the first three chapters of the Gita are one real strong prescription. It's strong medicine. As I said, the third chapter is karma yoga. Karma yoga is not easy. Yes, Uma.
One observation. Whether it may take me across from birth and death, I don't know. But one thing, regular, sincere practice, any spiritual practice, does make two things happen. The frequency of imbalance decreases. And second, the intensity of reaction subsides. These two are definite
Yes.
Results.
Yes, you're absolutely right. They've even made an acronym out of it in AA, Alcoholics Anonymous. FIR, F-I-R. Frequency, intensity, and recovery, time of recovery.
Oh, my goodness.
F-I-R. Hold on, I'll get to you in just a minute. We really need to be, we all know of those clown dolls, you know, they're weighted in the bottom, and they're plastic, they're shaped like this, and you bat them like this, and they go boop, 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 boop. Well, we do that.
Yeah.
We do that. Yes, in the back.
Hi, I just want to introduce myself. My name is Greg.
Yes, Greg.
And I just want to say how much I'm enjoying being here and what I'm learning. I was told by, you know, this place by my brother-in-law, Eddie.
Mm-hmm.
So he told me, you know, I would enjoy it. And I am. You know, I'm learning a lot.
Tremendous.
So, you know, I just wanted to comment, and it's kind of like on something that, a conversation we were having on our way here this morning. And it's like, it's more in line of like I realize that the more I know, the more I realize I don't know.
Yes.
You know? Because if I have a question, and every time I get one question answered, it gives rise to like 10 other questions.
Right? Exactly.
So I was talking to Eddie this morning about my dad, you know, God rest his soul. He passed away in 2009.
Hmm.
And he always used to, there's a saying he always used to, he wasn't a spiritual guy, but he was, he had good ideas. He
mm-hmm.
always
mm-hmm.
gave you like knowledge. So he used to say, behind mountains, there are more mountains, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So you could like see a mountain, and then you say, okay, once I climb this mountain, I'll be able to see everything.
Right.
And then I'll see everything, and I'll know everything was what's going on. But then when you get to the top, you look, and you see there's more mountains back there. And then they're higher than the one that you just climbed, you know? So it's, yeah, so it's like, you know, the more I know, the more I realize I don't know. And it's like a process, you know? So, but I'm really enjoying it.
Good. Well, every one of these spiritual paths here depends on our ability to learn how to concentrate. First, contemplate. In other words, get our ideas organized. Contemplate and get our idea. Then select the idea that we want to focus on. Concentration. And concentrate on that, and then it begins to open up and reveal itself to us. The answers begin to appear. And then, as that persists, meditation. Now, the meditation leads us through these various levels of our minds. I named them the active awareness, the waking awareness, the active subconscious, which is promoting what's happening in our waking awareness, and then our latent subconscious, which is promoting what's happening in our active, cooperating with it. And as we learn to meditate, and it takes years, but it's well worth the effort, we learn the contents of our mind, the things that Paul was talking about that affect our behavior, though we're not aware of it.
Yes.
You know, what our mother or some other person laid on us when we're 3 years old still goes around in our mind. They're like a pair of glasses we're wearing that color the world. They're green glasses, and so we see the world as green.
Mm-hmm.
So this is everything depends on, if we're going to make progress, on learning the contents of our mind and learning to control, as I said, our attention, so that our attention isn't constantly being scattered and fragmented mm-hmm. and pulled this way and that by the events in the world. That's why I started the talk the way I did. We start every day with the best of intentions. Some days everything goes well. Other days, just, what happened? Well, we lost control of our attention. We lost control of our intentions, which are the product of our attention. So, what happened? What's the solution? We gain control of our attention. and it can be done. And I mentioned the paths for doing it, and they are strong, successful paths, and that's why Swami Vivekananda said religion is a science, in the sense that, just like a chemistry workbook, you follow the directions in the chemistry workbook, you get predictable results. The same thing is true of each of these workbooks that I talked about, whether it's Narada's Bhakti Sutras, or whether it's Shankara's Crest Jewel of Discrimination. It's a matter of selecting according to the leanings of our nature, the bent of our nature, as the Native Americans call it, selecting what it is that works for us, and it helps to have the cooperation of a teacher, and then doing it. We learn by doing. And I'm going to make Dr. Mudge a promise. You talked about death and the educator that death is. Well, not only that's not in the, just in the Hindu scriptures. It's also in this, the teachings of this great Yaqui spiritual master, Don Juan Matus. And my promise is next year, not this year, I'm going to give a series of talks looking at each of the yogas through the lenses of Don Juan Matus, this great spiritual teacher from the Yaqui people of the...
You know, Brother Shankar, the time is getting late, but the discussion is getting thick and very attention-gathering. So I will make only two quick points. The thing that you said is of enormous importance. I would add to that one that the body and the mind have the natural capacity to bring back normalcy.
Mm-hmm.
You don't make any effort for that one. The body, day and night, whether you are aware of it or not, tries to restore the normalcy.
Yes.
And so does the mind.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, in response to Paul, I would say that there are many people who are born in very dire, demanding circumstances, but they turn out to be all right. So that is the natural prudence of the mind and the body to restore. And in relation with what he said, mountain after mountain after mountain,
mm-hmm.
it's so true. But by the time you climb the one mountain, you are not the same naive mountain climber. Now you know what is mountain climbing.
Yes.
So the second mountain will be a lot easier than the first mountain.
Very well said. Very well said. Exactly.
Hopefully.
First Sundar and then Swayam.
I like one of your comments which you made. Like, we might have like all the knowledge, but until it affects us, it's not going to have any impact. Say, like, for everyone knows that we are going to die. The same thing, the same knowledge like Ramana Maharishi had, but it affected him so much that drove him to like to realize God.
Mm-hmm.
So that is one thing. Like, every time we have the knowledge, like we study Jnana Yoga, like, not this, not this. Yes, it remains as a concept, but until it affects us, it's not
right.
Affecting.
Thank you, Sundar. Yes, Swayam.
Talking about this death and trying to remember that we are all mortal, there's a song in one of the Hindi films, you know, Tu Pyar Ka Sagar Hai. So it says that here is the dance of life happening and there is death standing, but nobody knows where the boundary is.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we think about, yes, we are mortal, we are going to die, it does bring an element of common sense about not planning too much for whether it's dinner or retirement savings. But then immediately the thing comes, what if I don't die? Then I'm going to have to plan. So the balance is between I'm going to die versus what if I don't die?
Yeah.
And I guess spiritual practice is the answer.
Insurance.
We
how much insurance?
The practice that yields the greatest is controlling your attention to the point where you're saying, what is the most productive thing I can do in this moment? Because this is the only moment you have. And this is what the practice of karma yoga yields: greater efficiency, greater skill in action. Because you are focused on the moment, you're focused on the action. So all of these have these great benefits. You know. And is it going to take us more than a week? Is it going to take us more than a month? Is it going to take us more than a year? Is it going to take us more than 10 years? Yes. But if we think about how old we are, if we buy the premise of reincarnation, we are eons old. However, whatever form we were in, we are eons old. So that's a lot of impressions left. So we train our attention to look at these impressions in the moment and say, is this important to me or not important? Does this deserve my attention? It rose up. It presented itself to me. Does it deserve my attention? As Robert said, and I admonished him a little bit for being, you know, peremptory about it, but you basically say, no. I'm not going to follow your lead. You have to go back to sleep. So, as Dr. Mudge pointed out, it is now 12:40-something.
I have one short thing.
Yes, please.
Going back to a statement that Paul made earlier about appearance, and I believe that we are a product, first, of our DNA. We consider that.
Mm-hmm.
Then we're a product of all of our earthly experiences, mm-hmm, in this life. Then thirdly, we are a soul that was built coming back with karma, mm-hmm, coming from earlier, which is who we really are and who we can work on resolving or improving or whatever that may be. But we have the choice,
mm-hmm,
of how to deal with these three aspects of life.
Mm-hmm.
If we want to include all these things, we can. If we want to select any one of them, we can.
Mm-hmm.
And ideally, if we could select the soul coming from karma, that would be ideally the ideal thing to do.
First you have to find it. That's the self-discovery.
But most of us don't have. We only have an experience of that person as a child, just born, before we go to school. Then we kind of forget that gets covered up with all this stuff. But we can go back and uncover that.
Yes, absolutely.
It's all up to us. We can choose.
And then we decide how much of this deserves my attention. And by the way, Paul, I applaud your objections. I applaud your bringing these things up. Sometime, if you'd like, we can have a discussion about the conversations between Margaret Noble, who became Sister Nivedita, and Swami Vivekananda in England in the 1890s, 1895, 96. She just beat him up fiercely. She was brilliant, just brilliant. And she just beat on him, you know, with raising the kinds of objections that you're just, as a generalization, the kinds of objections that you were raising. And she challenged him to answer her questions, and he was able to successfully. As I say, I applaud you raising these concerns and these objections. It's good.
Thank you.
All right. That'll probably do it for today. As I know, Elizabeth Yates, Jyoti, has gone to some trouble and even to some personal expense on their way here this morning to prepare a table for us in the monastery. So let's go enjoy what Jyoti has done for us. We'll close with our usual closing chant. Let there be peace in outer space.
Let there be
peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters. Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees. May the gods be peaceful. May the whole universe be pervaded by peace. Let this infinite universal peace prevail throughout my being. Om, peace, peace. Peace be unto us and to all beings everywhere. So thank you for this wonderful discussion we had after the talk. This is what it's all about. Us doing this together. This is what's meant by a congregation. A congregation means a coming together. With togetherness. So how beautiful. Let us go forward together. I'll see you inside.